Welcome to the Asia Climate Finance Podcast, where we discuss climate action-related business, finance, and investment topics, including issues around clean, green, net zero emissions, and sustainable energy, as well as climate, environmental, green, and sustainable finance. Welcome to the 30th episode of the Asia Climate Finance Podcast. Now, hundreds of billions of dollars in global assets follow ESG principles. The massive growth seen in the past few years is set to continue, estimate various investment banks. This means that ESG research has become one of the pillars of green finance, socially responsible investing, impact investing, and the like, and is becoming part and parcel of standard investment research. In this episode, one of the region's most respected ESG analysts, Charles Yontz, who heads Asian ESG research at Macquarie Group, first discusses the basics of the research that he does, including the approach and challenges. We then take a deeper dive into some of the interesting issues, including battery supply chains, especially cobalt and nickel, greenwashing, coal divestments, and other hot topics. Enjoy the show. Hi, welcome to episode 30 of the Asia Climate Finance Podcast. As mentioned, we have Charles Yontz, who's going to talk about ESG research. I'm really, really excited about talking to Charles because he's probably one of the people in the Asia Pacific region who knows the subject better than anybody else. So I'm very excited about that. Good afternoon, Charles. How are you?
Good afternoon, Joseph. Very well, thanks. How about yourself?
Very good. I'm just very excited to have you. So, and thank you very, very much for your time. I really appreciate it. Could we start, Charles, with just a quick wrap on your journey to ESG research, or just where you're at today?
Yeah, you bet. I'll try not to make this too long, but basically, I started along this path back in 2005, when I started covering solar stocks from Taiwan for Greater China. Now, that morphed into environmental type stocks. And by 2011, I also added in sort of ESG, or as we were calling it then, Sustainable Responsible Investment, SRI. Mm-hmm. And that remained kind of a side job for many years because it wasn't deemed large enough or important enough to be a full-time job, at least where I was at the time. But by 2018, 2019, that became more or less my full-time job. And that is very much what I've been focused on since 2020 when I joined Macquarie and moved over to Singapore, where I'm based now.
Just a follow-up question on that. Do you feel that your background on looking at clean energy initially made a difference in terms of looking at doing ESG research, I should say, given that, you know, today, as far as I'm aware, a lot of people just dive into ESG research. They don't really have the background. And like I've been saying quite a bit, you need, you know, it's a very complex kaleidoscope of a variety of things, including different taxonomies, there's legal issues, there's governmental policies, et cetera. So do you feel that that kind of helped? And if, you know, anybody wants to get into ESG research, would you recommend them to, you know, do a couple of other things on the side as well?
Yeah, no, good question. Definitely, it has had a big impact on how I've approached ESG. So I was a stock analyst for many years on sell side. And the idea from the get-go for me has been to incorporate these environmental and social metrics into stock selection, so into the investment process. And I have certainly seen that the other approach, which would be really looking at ESG to some degree in isolation. And that makes a bit more sense now because it's so much bigger than it was a decade ago, at least, everywhere, but certainly in Asia. So, yeah, it is a different approach now. And to me, I do see us, in a sense, coming back to that idea that you really do need to incorporate ESG into the investment process or into stock selection. So yeah, having another discipline to match it with is valuable, definitely.
Got it. So if we can get into the backdrop and ask you my first ridiculous question out of a series of ridiculous questions, which is, what it is that you do? You know, how do you conduct the research? How do you go about it?
Okay. Yeah, no, but fair question. Trying to work that out myself as well. It seems to be evolving and changing every day. But basically what I do is, and this is at Macquarie, and like I said before, based in Singapore, previously in Hong Kong, I set up a system for ESG assessments that all of our stock analysts around Asia use. So it's around 60 analysts. That's a moving target. 60 analysts and around 800 stocks that we cover. So I set up the system that they use to assess all of the companies that they cover on ESG issues. So I guess we'll be getting into details about what issues we're looking at, what KPIs, et cetera. But beyond that, and first, I also do look at thematic issues. And in coming back to that basis in solar and renewable energy and energy transition, I tend to focus quite a bit on climate, especially, and not at the exclusion of the other environmental issues and other social issues, et cetera. But there is a bit more of a focus on climate, and I do a lot of thematic work there on whatever catches my eye. Basically, I do have a pretty wide remit in terms of what I can look at. If, for example, the latest thing that I've been spending more time on is EV charging, but that is again, it moves. There's a lot going on, as you know. So that's where we are.
I do know there's actually probably too much going on, and try to keep up with everything is not that easy. Getting into some of the nitty-gritties of the research that you do, Charles, how do you integrate ESG at Macquarie? I mean, you know, it's very interesting because it is a leading broker, so you know, looking at ESG has become quite key for all brokers. So how do you integrate ESG at Macquarie?
Yeah, good question. And as again, for everyone else, it is evolving. But the way that we're looking at it is we've mapped out environmental and social issues based on SASB, so the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board. Many of your listeners would be familiar with this, and I apologize for bringing in an acronym so early. I'll try not to do that anymore. It will be unavoidable in some cases. So SASB is, for anyone who doesn't know, it's something that was set up over a decade ago in the US initially to pick out around 10 to 15 key metrics to look at for any of 76 different sectors for environmental and social issues. So again, we can get into details there, but essentially we've gone through each of those sectors with the sector analysts that are covering the stocks to pick out metrics that they need to look at for their companies, and then gather data, you know, with a variety of sources. That's another thing I'm sure we'll be getting into details on, but gather data from a variety of sources and mapped it to the SASB metrics that we've altered a little bit to reflect our coverage in Asia, where things are not always exactly the same as they would be in the US. And then for corporate governance, we've got a proprietary system. But corporate governance, you would tend to be looking at a pretty similar set of issues. So around board structure, around ownership, et cetera. And likewise, I'm sure we'll get into more details there.
And
once...
Go ahead, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Please. So sorry, once we've gathered the data, though, then it's... quite a bit of work really just trying to figure out how much of this is already in the price for the stocks that we're covering. That's ultimately what we're trying to figure out, and what's the direction of change, where are things going.
It is incredibly difficult, and I'm glad I'm not a stock analyst anymore, but so what do you guys do? You actually just you produce scores, and then you come up with a general view. You know, how do you Can you give us a tiny bit of detail on that front?
Yeah, you bet. So we do produce scores, but I don't think anyone really wants another ESG score. Scores out there already. So we see the process as very valuable, and the scores as a necessary evil to lead us to that process. So So when I would get this data compiled and mapped for the analyst, the stock analyst covering whatever stock in whatever sector, and then the analyst goes through that data, and they can add a certain subjective element to each of these metrics that they're looking at to try to assess whether there might be something happening that might not be reflected in the data that's in the annual report or in the sustainability report, et cetera. They take that data, they make those assessments, and then they ultimately come out with a view as to there is a score, but then there's also a score, a forward-looking score, and a score on, which is very subjective, the degree to which ESG issues are already reflected in the valuation and in the financial statements. And that's now all of that, the endpoints of what we're really after are quite subjective. And I feel we have to do a fair bit of work in order to get to that. But that's ultimately, again, what we're after.
What do you think are the key challenges? And I mean, you mentioned some of the challenges already, but what do you think are the main challenges that you face when you're doing, you know, ESG research? Is it the definitions and taxonomies? Is it a data quality? Is it other stuff? Can you go through these a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. I mean,
this could take several hours or days.
But
in a nutshell.
In a nutshell, yeah. And also, I'd like to prevent just me complaining about all of the issues that we face. Now, look, it's no secret that ESG data is not great in a sense, simply that we don't have a time series, a consistent data set comparing companies across markets and across sectors. It's not like financial data where we can, it's relatively straightforward what we need to look at and what we can pull out. So just figuring out what data to look at in the first place is, that's that first step. Like I said, we are mapped to SASB. There is definitely a unification happening around this alphabet soup of different standards and taxonomies. And we can go into a lot of these other acronyms, and I'm happy to, and we might have to, but there is still, there's still a disparate set of standards that you might be looking at. So that's step one. And actually, that's step two. Step one is figuring out what you're trying to do with this data. So in the case of an ESG data provider, and if you're trying to produce an ESG score, that's one thing, but that's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is figure out how this factors into the investment thesis. And it's not nearly as clear cut how you incorporate this data in a way that's useful and investment ready and is actually valuable to our clients. So that's step one. And then step two, of course, figuring out how you want to map the data. Like I said, that is getting better, and we will dig into that hopefully. Step three, accessing the data where there hasn't been that consistent reporting, although it's improving. All of the exchanges around the region, Asia certainly, not like we've been at the forefront, but Asia is catching up in a sense with reporting for corporates. And yeah, that's improving, but there's still a lot of gaps there. And that is, those have been the big issues. And the big issue that we face now is, there's a bit of an anti-ESG backlash, and there is a bit of certainly a lot of concern about greenwashing and many different levels to cover on that. And those would be kind of the front and center issues right now.
So going back to the basics, which I think, not I mean, people very familiar with ESG obviously know about it, but for those of us who are not kind of in the ESG game, so to speak, every day, I think there's a little bit of a lack of understanding in terms of how difficult it is to collect the data. So what's the main hurdles in data collection? What are the firms doing to overcome them? And then secondly, how do net zero data and disclosure requirements fit with those imposed by regulators and maybe in some of the main markets in Asia, like, you know, Hong Kong, Singapore, maybe Australia or Japan or whatever? And then thirdly, what does the industry-wide nature of the net zero project mean to, you know, mean for data collection? So three top questions on the road. And okay, you can answer good. In one word. No, just kidding.
Certainly, I'll try one. Good questions. So the thing that I'm optimistic about is that really there's been this coalition around the ISSB. So more or less a set of standards that's kind of rooted in SASB that I mentioned earlier. Mm. And many of the different exchanges and the regulators are also looking at ISSB as a way to set the ESG metrics that they would want to be reported. So that's encouraging, and that's happening now. If we'd look back just 2 years or 3 years, it wasn't clear that there would be any kind of standard that everything would gather around. The other standard is in the EU, really, so the green taxonomy. But we do have these two broad groups where we can see which metrics all the different markets and different companies would be looking at and that they would need to report to. So this is a big step forward. The other is when you get into climate TCFD, which I'm sure you are familiar with. Your listeners would likely be familiar with as well. So TCFD as a way to report on climate in a way that is not really just coming back to basic metrics, but actually gives you a bit more context around those metrics has been really important. And it's something that, again, the exchanges around the region and globally, as well as the regulators, have really latched on to. And that's the direction of travel, at least, is very clear now. And this is something that's live in that the first reports with ISSB, the standards are just getting locked down. And in 2023, we'll have, should have, a lot of transparency and a lot of visibility around where we're headed. So as we look out 2 to 3 years, there will be this consistent set of baseline ESG reporting metrics, and that will get over the biggest hurdle around data collection. The other thing that has been ongoing and continues to improve is the use of and the structuring of unstructured data. So effectively web scraping to media reports, NGO reports. We do this, a lot of people do this, in order to map different issues to the metrics that we're looking for. So even where there's not reporting, it's becoming much, much easier to gather that data, gather the relevant data in a way that we can actually make sense of it and start to analyze for the company, our investment proposal, our investment thesis, et cetera.
I think, the takeaway, which I kind of mentioned in a few of the other episodes, is that this is really evolving. And the way that I look at it is where you are today relative to 5 years ago, relative to 10 years ago. And there are some controversies, et cetera, but like everything that is evolving, there's teething pains or, growing pains. And I think, where at least my very biased opinion is that, all of this anti-ESG noise, et cetera, is will probably dissipate over the next, 3-5 years, definitely. A little bit just like clean energy. Remember like 5-10 years ago where people said, solar doesn't work because there's no sun at night and wind doesn't work when there's no wind. And so forget about renewables. And now, nobody really talks about that because it's a much better understanding of some of the basics that, for example, clean energy works with energy storage. So I think taking that example to ESG, again, my own biased opinion is that you have standards that are evolving, developing, fine-tuning, et cetera. And it's just an evolution, basically. And then, like you kind of hinted to, like I've said before, you know, the train has already left the station, whether you like it or not. So, and if you don't get on, you're going to miss it. So, yeah. But sorry for that soliloquy on my personal opinion. Now, if we look at, go ahead.
Oh no! So the sun doesn't shine at night, and yeah. Look, these talking points are still out there. Sadly, like the idea, someone who's pulling this is like a big surprise that solar doesn't work at night and wind power isn't very good when there's no wind. But yeah, absolutely. I think most people are aware that there are ways around this at this stage. And certainly, yeah, the train has left the station. I would agree there.
So moving on, you know, we talked about data quality quite a bit. Mm-hmm. We kind of hinted too about, you know, definitions and taxonomies as well. Can we talk about the tightening ESG focus for clean companies, mm-hmm. clean in inverted commas?
Yes. Certainly. So where we've seen, or I've seen an inordinate amount of demand for kind of ESG analysis has been around specifically energy transition, especially energy transition related companies. So talking about solar panel manufacturers, anything in the EV supply chain. And these companies naturally are coming under more scrutiny because of that clean in inverted commas, they're coming under more scrutiny on ESG issues. So the kind of post, it's easier with an example. If we look back to, say, 2018, that's when this first started picking up, in at least to me, in my, you know, first popped up on my radar in 2018, when we're suddenly becoming aware of the issues around cobalt. Mm-hmm. So the vast majority of cobalt comes from the DRC, so from the Congo, and around 20% of that is mined artisanally, so by hand. Artisanal always sounds to me like it would be very fancy, but it just means very high risk by hand mining. Pretty messy operations, and with some child labor involved. How much, unclear. But when that first popped up, there was, I think it was Oxfam or possibly Greenpeace report, and started pushing this through. Then the automakers came under fire, and Apple came under fire for having batteries that were using cobalt that allegedly used slave labor from the Congo. Mm-hmm. And so when these, all the way downstream, the auto OEMs or Apple or Samsung or whomever, went to their battery suppliers to ask them about this, you know, how exposed are we to this problem? Or, you know, is this a risk for us? Can you prove, or you better be able to prove, that we don't have any cobalt that's been mined illegally in the Congo? And the battery manufacturers then went to their cathode suppliers, who went to their cobalt suppliers. And basically, no one knew. So they came out and got caught really flat-footed and unable to say what was happening in the supply chains. Now, over the course of the next couple of years, there were very rapid, in retrospect, developments to map the supply chain for batteries, mm-hmm. and for cobalt in particular, and then to introduce audit processes and to ensure that actually the supply is relatively clean. Now, there's still debate about exactly how risky the cobalt supply is, mm-hmm. and the best way to manage that. But this really highlighted an issue, because we're talking about EVs, and where if you're looking for something that is going to ultimately have a positive impact on the environment relative to the baseline or versus an ICE vehicle, then it doesn't make sense if you're using slave labor or if you are using some sort of materials that are destroying the environment in the process of production. So that was with cobalt. What we've really seen this now is around lithium and nickel in Indonesia in particular. We could talk more about that. But also in solar supply chains, where you know, feel like there is a bit more scrutiny for these manufacturers than there would be for products that aren't being used in the energy transition or aren't being used for some sort of sustainable goal or some sort of ESG type goal. And that's just ratcheting up. And for fears of greenwashing above all. So mm-hmm. any company or any investor in a company that is absolutely terrified and for good reason of being accused of greenwashing. And that's kind of the issue that they're looking at. Therefore, again, more scrutiny, a lot more scrutiny, and that's ramping up as we speak.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess to just wrap the subject of or this particular case study of batteries, mm-hmm. the materials are going to the batteries, is that it is a risk to the company. It is a risk to the investor that a company is doing that, because you know ultimately they may have they may get fines, they may get all sorts of get into all sorts of trouble. So that's where you can say, well, yeah, ESG, anti-ESG, and all this noise that is going on. But at the end of the day, it is really a risk to the company. So as an investor, if you don't have a very good understanding of the supply chains or the individual risks, you're actually putting your money to risk as well, right? So
absolutely. And actually, what you just hit on there is kind of the foundation of ESG and one of the ways to look at it. And more or less the way that we usually look at it is a risk. These are risks that as an investor, you should be aware of, whatever you're calling them, whatever the label is, you should be aware of these environmental and social risks that might not be in the financial statements yet, but they will be, or very credibly should be. And corporate governance, of course, is really about protecting the rights of minority shareholders. So if we're, among other things, but that's a big part of it. And if you are a minority shareholder in a company and you don't care about the rights of minority shareholders, then that doesn't really make sense. So again, this anti-ESG backlash kind of, from that point of view, doesn't make sense at all. But you kind of also do hit on the crux of this big question about ESG and in some sense, a legitimate argument against it, which is that people don't necessarily know what they're getting with the package, with the label. If I think of ESG as being this sort of risk mitigation tool, and these are metrics and things that you should be looking at, being a responsible investor, part of your fiduciary responsibility. But some of these funds might be perceived as what we would consider like an impact fund. So meant to be achieving or helping to achieve some positive social or environmental goal. And there's that mismatch and an unclear labeling that means that some investors probably are not getting what they're expecting with these funds. Mm-hmm. And plenty of examples there that we could dive into.
You mentioned the kind of major issue and very topical issue of greenwashing. So could you talk a little bit about that? Perhaps maybe EU greenwashing to use a case study and maybe start with a 101 and the basics and get into the legitimate concerns. I'm not really sure if you want to touch on the US political issues as well, although that's another can of worms. Could you discuss a little bit about greenwashing, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, certainly. So many different ways to look at greenwashing, and there are all kinds of other sort of related terms that have popped up around greenwashing, like green wishing, green hoping, all kinds of different things. But for us, or for myself, when we're looking at greenwashing, usually what we'd be talking about would be a company that is not really doing what it is presenting as what it's doing with regards to environmental or social claims. And the case study that would be in textbooks already would be Volkswagen and around Dieselgate. So whilst spinning this whole idea that there was a big push for environmental improvements and diesel was the way of the future because you, at least for now, you could reduce emissions substantially, they were, of course, cheating on their emissions tests and very well proven, and there's it already is well established. So that would be an extreme case of greenwashing. You know, many other cases, of course. Also, what we would see and what we're wary of for greenwashing is corporates, generally larger corporates, who have the resources to put good PR teams to work on their sustainability reports. And they are then gaming the system for the ESG ratings vendors, you know, the MSCIs and the Sustainalytics of the world, who are well aware and are certainly trying to avoid that. But they're gaming that system to get higher scores and meanwhile doing as little as possible to actually change their business. So greenwashing, that again, that's kind of been the main focus for us. For our clients, so for investors, the main concern around greenwashing and what the EU is focused on in particular is around presenting, making sure that investment products that are being touted as, quote, green or sustainable are actually green or sustainable. And the way that's, yeah, the other acronym that is unavoidable, unfortunately, there is SFDR, or the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, by which the EU regulators have very specific requirements for what you need to do in order to call a fund light green or Article 8 or dark green or like an impact fund, which is Article 9. They've taken a very specific and rigorous approach to how funds can label themselves to not be accused of greenwashing. And this is something that is also live, and it's a pretty onerous task for fund managers or for investment managers to match up. But it's also something that is to some extent being emulated by other regulators and including those around the region here, as a way just to set some labels and some baselines as to what you need to do in order to define your fund as green or to label it as green or sustainable. It's going to be a difficult, somewhat messy process, but I think we are moving in the right direction, at least in order to build more confidence around these products.
And just not to open the massive can of worms, which is the US political issues, but and I did discuss this in one of the podcasts where I got a non-empirical, more like a feeling that the most advanced region in this front is Europe, and then Asia is improving very, very fast, but behind. And then the US is a little bit of a mess in the sense that, you know, in some areas it's quite advanced, in some areas it's extremely backwards. Is there anything you want to mention on that front? In 30 seconds. No, just kidding.
In 30 seconds. Yeah, no, certainly. That's a trick. It's tough, right? So one, I feel like we get an outsized impression of how important the U.S. is to ESG investing. Again, most of our clients are emerging market investors or Asia focused investors, and we're dealing with Asian corporates. And if you look at the media impression, this ESG backlash, there would be a headline around something around an ESG backlash. And then if you look into it, it is the Florida state pension, which is large. I mean, it's important, but you'll push back against ESG in Florida or in West Virginia or, you know, at the state level in the US, as part of kind of this political grandstanding, in my view, but that doesn't extend. So it's state level, whereas at the federal level, clearly the SEC is ratcheting up requirements for reporting both around climate and more broadly around ESG. And that's happening, whether, you know, the states are excited about it or not. And other states are actually, of course, broadly supportive of this ratcheting up of ESG requirements, California being an obvious example. But it does, maybe I'm too far away from it, and therefore I'm not paying as much attention as I should, but it does feel like a lot of noise for a relatively small impact. You know, not a small impact, really, but just in terms of versus the overall global push, and even versus the federal push in the US, and versus all of the exciting things that are happening in terms of supporting the energy transition in the US in particular under the current administration.
No, and I think it is really important to understand that there's different, let's say, speeds of change, where you've got, you know, you've got Europe, you've got Asia, and you've got the US, and it's really three different separate jurisdictions. Although a lot of these issues are global, and some of the taxonomies or rules, regulations, etc., will become global, but because what's emanating out of the US, especially places like Florida, it's almost outsized, if I can put it that way. But that's just my two pennies worth. Great. Well, I think we've covered the 101 as well as we could, in terms of you sharing your thoughts about, you know, how you do the research, what are the things you consider, some of the many, not some, but the many, many, many challenges, which at the end of the day, I guess, are related or devolve around the fact that this is an evolutionary process when it comes to like ESG rules, regulations, et cetera. So now I want you to get the, you know, crystal ball out of the drawer of your desk and talk about, you know, where you see things happening, knowing that, you know, the energy transition amongst many of the subjects is not something which is going to happen overnight, but, you know, over the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years and beyond. So how do you see ESG research, what's your outlook on that? And there was, just to mention one comment, I had one comment from one person I interviewed for a podcast, a few podcasts ago, a few episodes ago, which was, at the end of the day, ESG is just going to become part of the, you know, the way you do research. I mean, it's just part of it. It's not going to be something labeled ESG. The label ESG won't exist. It'll be part of the research that you're doing, just like you look at, I don't know, at using valuations or doing DCF or whatever. And one of the things is those risks. So what's your kind of outlook on ESG research in general?
I couldn't agree more with whoever that was on the podcast a few episodes ago. No, ESG is ultimate. It's really important. And in a sense, it's not important at all, in that it doesn't matter whether it's labeled ESG or not. But these are issues that will be very relevant. I mean, you could consider them as part of the, part of the intangibles, and just part and parcel of investing. Like, if you can't have a comprehensive view of the company without taking into account what they're doing around climate, you know, what is their stance on climate? How are they treating their employees? How are they treating their suppliers? these are obviously important issues. Now, it's long seemed like kind of the holy grail, at least for me and for the people I've worked with, to be able to take ESG metrics and apply them very specifically to valuation. So, for example, if your ESG score is X, then you're going to add 12 bips to the WACC, and your DCF valuation is going to come down, or you'll change the price earnings multiple target to reflect that, you know, to some very specific number, you know, 13% increase to reflect better ESG, et cetera. Or on financial statements, we'll have a line item for carbon emissions, and you'll be able to plug in a price for carbon, and that will affect your P&L, or for water, wastewater treatment, et cetera. So to be able to have all these line items explicitly built into models, and to some extent, we see that happening. But what we have seen, and really I would expect that we'll continue to see, is this trend toward full integration into analysis. So it is the portfolio managers who are looking at ESG issues, not the sort of separate ESG team that's considering them. That's already very clearly happening. And it's something that sell side, I guess, is a little bit behind with, but, that's really where we see all of the value. And in fact, where I get all of the value in my job now as well is working with the analysts who actually know the companies, know the stocks. And I do come with my own, you know, ideas. And sometimes they're proven just totally irrelevant to what is actually happening at the company. And then, you know, figuring out why that's the case and why in this specific instance we don't actually need to worry about some particular issue, or we need to worry about some other issue more, is something that you could only do when you're integrating into the full investment thesis. Yeah, and we have seen this though as well. Really going back to a decade ago, ESG teams were mostly kind of very separate and kind of at the kiddie table, when the adults making decisions would either consider or not, usually, whatever was coming out of the ESG team. And that clearly has changed very much already. And I would just consider that trend will continue.
Cool. If we can move on to almost, let's call it a different dimension. No, not a third dimension or anything like that, but just about specific hot issues and mainstream technologies of concern to investors, so that, you know, we may be able to put in a little bit more color in a lot of some of the theoretical stuff that we mentioned. So I'll try to kind of pick your brain, if you don't mind, on some of these, you know, hot issues and mainstream technologies of concern to investors. So maybe we can start with just to pick one randomly, reshoring and nearshoring, and, you know, talk about the IRA, the EU, et cetera. Well, any?
Okay, yeah, that's a big one. So certainly, I could say the issues that I've been obsessed with recently, and yeah, just laying them out, would be IRA and, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act. That would be not the Irish Republican Army. I grew up with that acronym in the 80s. But so the Inflation Reduction Act, and which also relates to ESG in different ways. So I'll come to that. Coal divestment or fossil fuel divestment. I feel there's some exciting changes underway there as to how that's been approached. And the other area really where I've been spending more time would be coming back to the supply chains and ESG in the supply chains, and really looking at Indonesia and nickel in particular. So, yeah, first on IRA, you know, Inflation Reduction Act, a big focus of that is to bring more of the supply chains for energy transition, so for solar, for batteries, et cetera, to the US, and also to ensure that there's not too much reliance on China. Although China is not explicitly called out there, it is an open, very, very open secret that that is the target. So, you know, it's something that we're watching because China, of course, does dominate solar and battery manufacturing. Again, no secret, really, along the supply chains fully. So we've seen something along the lines of $90 billion in CapEx for the U.S. since the IRA was first passed in August of last year. And what we're watching for in particular is what I'm interested in is what this is going to mean for costs, you know, just how quickly capacity will really be able to be ramped up in the U.S. And in those countries where there are free trade agreements with the U.S. How quickly capacity will be able to ramp up and what it will mean for costs. And there's a lot of talk about this, but I don't see enough around hard numbers. I mean, there is something about, okay, understandably, the risk of having all of the supply chain dominated by one country is clearly not ideal. But China's manufacturing prowess has had a profoundly deflationary impact on solar prices or on battery prices, right? Like, we wouldn't be where we were, where we are today without the cost impact of China. So what will that mean? And yeah, this is going to be interesting to watch, and hopefully it doesn't mean that we get set back in terms of the cost curves that have been driving. Part of this is interesting as well in that it ties into ESG, or it is being tied into ESG, in that proponents of the IRA, or the idea of building capacity in the US, is being pushed partly in search of more sustainable supply chains. And that is certainly, I think, in the reality of it, to some extent, certainly how it's being marketed. So to have cleaner supply chains, cleaner lithium production, cleaner battery production, et cetera. And you know, bringing that into the US is not the only way to do it, but it is, these two elements are very much going hand in hand in how it's being promoted. So yeah, IRA, exciting, early. And it's also what I think, coming back to something that you brought up earlier about how there's this ESG backlash in effectively red states or in Republican states, the states with the most inflow of both manufacturing capacity for renewables and for batteries and EVs, as well as installations, solar farms, wind farms, et cetera, are those that are getting the biggest benefit are also red states. You know, like, so whether or not that is going to have any impact on the ESG backlash and maybe lead to a backlash against the ESG backlash is something that I'm very keenly watching as well.
What about the, I mean, now that we talked about the IRA out of the US, what about the EU Net Zero Industry Act?
So we've done less on that, but it's just interesting to see this. If we look at the EU specifically, great, but we can even see this in other countries. So in Korea, for example, where you have this, in a sense, this green arms race. So where there's this push to provide more and more incentives to build up clean energy industries in each of these countries, or in the case of the EU and the bloc. And that is kind of what looks like is happening. And it's also early to say how that will play out. Is that going to be the most efficient use of capital? Clearly not. But it also means that there would be a lot of opportunities popping up that would not be in anybody's base case scenario in terms of where investment opportunities are along the supply chain.
So did you want to tackle some of the other, I was going to say big, but big is an understatement, massive, humongous topics that you mentioned, like, coal and also some of the EV charging and the supply chains there?
Yeah, certainly. So I just going into another big topic, not quite as big as the others, but this would be nickel in Indonesia. And it's interesting just as a test case, really, of how serious sustainability of the supply chains for batteries, for EVs, and how serious the oversight will be there and what can be done. So, Indonesia is becoming the largest provider of nickel for batteries, for EVs or anything else. And the deposits there are not nearly as good. The quality is not as high of the ore versus Australia. So it takes a lot more processing, and I'm oversimplifying here, but basically it means a lot more energy and more processing, more energy, and also more slag, more tailings. Risk to biodiversity, carbon emissions, everything goes up versus this, if you have a higher quality ore that you're working with to begin with. And trying to balance this expansion, there's been such a big push in Indonesia, and it's very important and absolutely crucial to the EV expectations globally that we get these, get this capacity. But, is it worth it if you're going to be clear cutting the rainforest in these biodiverse regions? And the answer, of course, is no. So how do you balance that? I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing from the industry, which there would be IRMA in particular, IRMA, which is, and also battery passports that the auto OEMs in the EU and in the US are putting into place to ensure that there are quite rigorous checks, surprisingly, actually rigorous checks on how the miners and processors are dealing with the environmental and social challenges of mining in these regions. And a lot of this isn't actually visible like in an annual report. So we can see, and increasingly it should be. This is kind of a frustration that we see with the ESG data elsewhere as well, and going through like tech supply chains, everything. They're selling to ultimately to Apple. There are very rigorous checks in place and audits in place. A lot of these aren't reflected in the ESG reports that investors see. And I think that we will be soon getting much better visibility into kind of the checks that the clients are requiring. And my impression is that actually there are ways around the kind of environmental challenges of getting nickel out of Indonesia that probably aren't quite appreciated yet. So I'm relatively optimistic there, but it is, there are challenges. The other big one, of course, is fossil fuel divestment, or coal divestment in particular. This is something that really just 2 years ago, it seemed clear to me that we would be moving. We saw all of these funds and all of the asset owners and investment managers and financial institutions of other sorts, introducing divestment plans for fossil fuels and for coal specifically, for thermal coal. So they wouldn't have any exposure to thermal coal miners or thermal coal IPPs, power companies, anyone burning coal or digging it up. And it looked like we were clearly going to be moving toward from coal to oil and different types, more sensitive oil, deep sea exploration, Arctic exploration, and then you work your way down to all the other fossil fuels. But that has changed. And with coal in particular, I think probably the most interesting thing to have come out of the global climate confabs last year was the Just Energy Transition Partnerships, which were actually kicked off in Glasgow the year before. But by which there's a $20 billion US plan for Indonesia, you know, followed by in Vietnam, and India should be up next. South Africa was the first, where this $20 billion goes to financing early shutdowns of coal-fired power plants. And rather than kind of a divestment campaign where the company who owns the coal-fired power plant sells the coal plant to someone else who is probably private equity and won't have to answer to any sort of ESG goals, now we actually explicitly have a shutdown of this plant. And that seems to be a much more effective way, where you're not just moving the assets from one hand to another hand, but rather actually ensuring that they're shut down. So I don't know if you've looked at the Just Energy Transition Partnerships much.
A little bit.
So it's very tricky, and it's very tricky as well because investors who would possibly like to get involved with these early shutdowns are restricted from having any exposure to coal, regardless of how it works. So they can't get involved. They can't actually finance the early shutdowns of these plants. So those are some of the issues we're working around there, but quite encouraging to see this development. And there's naturally quite a lot going on more or less across the board. So in terms of these transition and in particular ways to ensure transition and ways to keep the lights on, as everyone knows, we do need fossil fuels for a while, but at the same time, not give them free rein to be running forever and trying to strike that balance.
One last area. I mean, you know, there's dozens of areas we could be discussing, but I think one that has been in the headlines of late is you know, ChatGPT and some of the competing, you know, platforms like Google's Bard and others. And not to talk about, you know, ChatGPT replacing analysts, which I don't think is going to happen tomorrow morning. Looking at it from the kind of data utilization and data centers perspective, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, hopefully not replaced analysts yet, but like yourself, I'm sure, and like everybody, I have been playing around. It's pretty crazy. It's impressive. Right. There are a lot of ESG issues to look at, you know, ethical issues to look at, but just owning in around generative AI, but owning in on or homing in on, sorry, the power consumption. Yes. Like any other tech advance, anything else that's increasing the demand for data centers, generative AI like ChatGPT, like Bard, like Ernie, is driving up demand for data centers, and therefore that is driving up demand for energy and thus carbon emissions, right? So that much is clear cut, and it just highlights the importance of really focusing. I mean, what we look at when we're looking at data centers, we're looking at the internet companies. What we look at, and I think what everyone looks at, would be around energy efficiency. So the PUE, power usage effectiveness ratio. So how much of the power that's consumed is actually going to computations, and with one being perfect and targeting getting closer to one. Now, average, I think, is around 1.3 globally. And, you know, bringing that number down is something that we see as a big marker for how serious the different internet companies are about this. Now, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, and also in China, so Baidu, Tencent, have been working and very increasingly transparent about what they're doing to improve that metric. And they're very focused on the metric. It's a big cost for them as well, obviously. So it's important. The other is naturally renewables and being able to source carbon-free power. So it just magnifies the importance of sourcing carbon-free power. And this is an area where Asia has been way behind in general versus the U.S. names. And coming back to Google and Microsoft, we're already moving into 24/7 green energy procurement. We're starting to see advances now, but I would expect to see that accelerate. And with gentle nudges and not so gentle nudges from each of the governments where those data centers are located, and that being both the national governments like China, but also city governments, Shanghai, with very specific targets and requirements for the data centers that are operating there. So ultimately, that generative AI, it does come back to just, it's another driver for data centers and therefore a massive energy consuming sector that with growing energy consumption, and it's just going to be growing more quickly than people had previously anticipated. We see the metrics getting, or the forecast getting ratcheted up across the board, and that will continue to happen.
Charles, this has been absolutely fantastic, and what the Asia Climate Finance podcast is all about, which is, sharing your insights, your experience, and, done a fantastic job explaining the kind of 101, explaining that ESG is just not an acronym, and just an acronym, sorry. and it's a research approach. And then, a lot of case studies to put a little bit of color on all that. Before we wrap up, do you have any kind of final thoughts or key takeaways that you want to highlight, you want to emphasize?
Yeah, well, one, thanks for the opportunity. It's been fun. Look, the key points really just like what you just said, ESG is just becoming part and parcel of standard research to do a complete job. If you're really going to look at an investment, really going to look at a company, ESG just needs to be part of that process. And, we are absolutely getting there. Despite all of the noise, backlash, greenwashing, et cetera, we are clearly moving in that direction. There's no turning that around. So that's encouraging. And, it's still a big fight to get through. Look, there's still a lot to get done. There's an outrageous amount of work to do. So I would stop there, actually. I would not put any of that in. The answer is no, thank you. I think you captured it very well. I couldn't put it in any better than what you've just done. It's been a great opportunity. I appreciate it. And I look forward to catching up again.
No, thank you very, very much for your time. You've been very, very generous with your time. I know how busy you are. And again, thank you so much for participating in the Asia Climate Finance podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Please contact us for any thoughts on topics or comments. Contact details are in the show notes.